This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
The book is called WASPs, and in this case, it stands for White Anglo-Saxon Protestants. The subtitle for the New York lawyer Michael Knox Barron's examination of the WASP culture is The Splendors and Miseries of an American Aristocracy. The people featured in the book are familiar names from history: Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, Dean Acheson, Henry Adams, Averell Harriman, T.S. Eliot, Walter Lippmann, Joe Alsop, and Whitaker Chambers, to name a few. Author Barron's publisher, Pegasus, writes that WASPs were creatures of glamour, power, and privilege, yet they were unhappy. Michael Knox Barron, we should start by you defining what a WASP is.
Well, I think the best way to understand them, Brian, is that they were, I would call them displaced Brahmins, people who were descended from, really from the founders of the country, the people that shaped, invented the American Republic. And yet after the Civil War, they found themselves being overshadowed in a very different world. It was now dominated by plutocrats, tycoons, urban party bosses, and they could no longer play the sort of civic part that they were accustomed to. The historian Richard Hofstadter has described them as patricians without a purpose. And what I think is interesting and sort of larger point about them is the way they reinvented themselves at that point. They were appalled not just by the changes in the power structure of America, but by what seemed to them a sort of narrowing of purpose, that the country had lost some of the idealism that it had had at the founding. And they sort of tried to, you know, create a sort of new kind of humanism in which they would participate in different activities, sort of get them out of their own funk and make a contribution to the country.
Name some of your favorite WASPs.
Well, I think the guy you have to begin with is Henry Adams. He's descended from two presidents. His grandfather is John Quincy Adams. His father is John Adams. And in some ways, it was an impossible legacy to live up to, and he very much felt that. What was he going to do with his life? What he ended up sort of doing is saying that we need to form a class of public-spirited people who can counter some of the narrowness of American life, who could sort of keep a larger idea of what it might mean to be a free country in an industrializing age. So you have him as an early exponent of what the Roosevelts would do in their public service, laying the foundations for basically for the modern welfare state. But he would also, at the same time, was interested in a whole other aspect of WASP culture, which is, you know, bringing museums to cities, creating schools that will really reach the soul and allow people to develop their potential.
What do you think his reaction would be if he came back today, went to the location of his old house, which is now the Hay Adams Hotel, the location is, and walked out of the hotel and saw something called Black Lives Matter Plaza?
I think he would understand that that is progress. His own family were an anti-slavery family. That said, they did not really live up to the idea of actually taking people who are not from their own class and ethnic group seriously as full equals. And I think he would be impressed that the country was now doing a much better job at things that he and his ancestors had aimed at but had fallen short in.
Well, what if he'd have walked...
That said, he would understand Black Lives Matter. I think he would sort of be appalled by the way the whole cityscape had grown up with the gigantic buildings and a kind of culture that didn't speak to that wholeness of human potential, which was so essential to his own life and indeed to the H.H. Richardson house that he built on Lafayette Square right next to John Hayes.
What kind of money did he have?
They were comfortable. I mean, his grandfather, Peter Brooks, was one of the richest men of America in his time. The fortune was divided among children and grandchildren, but Henry never had to work for a living. He worked as a professor at Harvard, but the income from the family trusts, while he would complain about being a poor man compared to, say, John Hay, who married the daughter of one of the richest men in Ohio, the Wasps were very comfortable, which I think is interesting. This is partly why they supported some of the progressive reforms that Theodore Roosevelt and later Franklin Roosevelt would champion. They were not anti-capitalists. They weren't radicals. They didn't want to destroy that. They had a lot of property they wanted to keep. They thought the best way to do that, though, in a changing industrializing economy was to provide a safety net, to provide some social security for people who were falling behind.
Tell me if I'm right about this. You went to Groton. You went to Columbia University. You went to Cambridge, where you got a master in philosophy, and then you got a law degree from Yale. Is that right?
That's right, yep.
You write a lot about Groton. What is it like today or when you were there compared to what you're writing about in your book about wasps?
Well, I think that Groton was Henry Adams' two nephews were there, and Franklin Roosevelt was there. Theodore Roosevelt was a good friend of its headmaster, Endicott Peabody, who offered him a job of teaching there. Teddy didn't teach. He went out west instead, but he sent his sons there. And that school became a real impetus for the kind of WASP culture that was going to take people that could sit around and lounge all day in their clubs on their trust funds. They were going to turn them into sort of public-spirited citizens who would take a role in public service, but who would also, you know, do the other things about making a humane contribution to the communities in which they found themselves. And Groton did that by really taking on pre-modern ideas about how you really reach young souls that are very common in all kinds of older communities, going back to Athens, where you use great literature or poetry to sort of open the mind and help it realize its potential. This Greek idea, Renaissance idea, was really crucial to the WASP revival, and it ended up working, and it did produce a class of these sort of civic generalists, I would call them, who made contributions in various aspects of American life.
Who was Joe Alsop?
He was an interesting character who was both a WASP who analyzed it very shrewdly. He described his class as sort of the WASP ascendancy. He described the different, what he called recognition signals that would allow WASPs to sort of identify each other wherever they found themselves, you know, certain manners of dressing, speaking, laughing, what they considered funny, inside jokes. He described a lot of how their power operated, their privilege, but at the same time, he was also very much trying to live that WASP idea that you will do justice to different aspects of your nature, this old sort of Renaissance ideal or Athenian ideal. It meant a lot to him because he became a great newspaper columnist, Cold War hawk, but he was also interested in the rare art traditions, collected all kinds of Asian antiquities and art, tremendously knowledgeable about literature, was famous for the sort of style of his house and the style of the entertainments he gave there, which were very sort of sophisticated, almost in the fashion of the old Athenian or Greek symposia, which are supposed to be you know, not just having fun, but having fun on sort of a higher plane where the fun leads to talk about, you know, what should we be doing in life? What's the point of life? That kind of broad philosophic approach to life.
As you know, he lived in Georgetown, and he had a certain way of talking, almost sounds European. He let our cameras in there in 1984 in December twice. We got to talk with him over a period of a couple of hours. I'm going to run just a little clip so people can hear what he sounded like. And at one point, he was incredibly visible in Washington in the Washington Post. But here is what he sounded like. And just keep in mind, he had always had a cigarette in his hand.
I went to Groton.
Prep school.
And yes. And I was a rather friendless boy when I was little, and I made friends when I was 13, 14. I'd learned that it was a bore not to have friends. And they were going to Harvard, so I went to Harvard, that's all. And it certainly wasn't an ideal educational experience, if you mean that. I read enormously. I enjoyed myself enormously. I drank enormously. In fact, I became a newspaper man because my family were afraid if I stayed at Harvard Law School, which had been my intention, I'd turn into a drunk like all my mother's uncles. Probably would have, too.
Mr. Barron, your reaction?
Well, replaying that, it does bring to mind just how eccentric, though, their manners and ways of speaking and that whole aspect of their sort of character was. But it's quite charming and I think quite powerful, and it again speaks to the way that they were determined to do justice to what was in them. The rest of the world be damned if they didn't like it. I mean, few people could speak with that kind of idiosyncrasy that Joe Alsop does in those memorable C-SPAN interviews.
In your book, you quote Walter Lippmann in a letter he wrote to Leonard Hand. Before I read one little bit of it, who was Walter Lippmann?
One of Joe Alsop's rival columnists, one of the great 20th century columnists, got his start under in the Bull Moose era of Theodore Roosevelt, knew every president quite well or somewhat well, and tremendous shaper of American opinion for much of the 20th century, up through the 1960s anyway.
How are you able to be a WASP when you're Jewish?
Well, I think the WASPs I'm dealing with in the book, it really becomes almost more of a state of mind than just a particular ethnic or genetic strand. Obviously, most of them were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and probably most were, in fact, Episcopalians within Protestantism. But you have people like Bernard Berenson, the art critic, Walter Lippmann, who were taken not so much, I think, with the snobbish aspect of the WASPs, their exclusive clubs, but precisely with their idea of humane education and developing your own potential. That's Walter Lippmann. He was at Harvard and studied under William James and Santayana, the philosopher who expanded his mind. Bernard Berenson, very much the same thing. It was that aspect of WASPdom that I think attracted them and which made them what I would call honorary WASPs. You could see a little bit of it in John F. Kennedy, I think, too.
In the book, you refer to his Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, published in 1922, and The Phantom Public, which appeared in 25. I'm going to read what he said. I'll take it slow so people can absorb it. He said, "My own mind has been getting steadily anti-democratic," he wrote to Leonard Hand in 1925. "The size of the electorate, the impossibility of educating it sufficiently, the fierce ignorance of these millions of semi-literate priest-ridden and parson-ridden people have gotten me to the point where I want to confine the action of the majorities. What do we think of that today?
Well, this goes really to the heart of one of the contradictions of the WASPs. They wanted to be a patrician class that would guide public opinion and the rest of the country, yet they always maintained that they were not going to be aristocrats. And Joe Alsup was very, very adamant, very sensitive on this point. When George Kennan, the great diplomat, once said to Alsup, "You know, Joe, the trouble with this country is that we are a democracy and we instead should be ruled by aristocrats," Alsup replied that, "Well, you know, I was very nearly sick when George said that." He said, "You know, there are no aristocrats in America. This is, we're a egalitarian nation." But there was always this tension between being good, public-spirited citizens of a democratic republic, yet wanting to influence it and mold it for what they thought would be its better good.
I count about four books that you've written. 98, you did The Last Patrician, Bobby Kennedy. 2003, Jefferson's Demons, Portrait of a Restless Mind. 2007, Forge of Empires, 61 to 71. You wrote about Abraham Lincoln and Otto von Bismarck and Tsar Alexander II. And then you had the 2015 Murder by Candlelight, and now this book on WASPs. What else do you do?
By profession, a lawyer, though I'm now retired.
And where do you live?
I live in Westchester County, New York, about an hour's drive outside of New York City.
As I pointed out earlier, you were a Groton student. You were a Columbia student in New York, then Cambridge in Great Britain, and then Yale. Could you fit in the WASP group today or even back then in the 20s and 30s?
No, in the 20s and 30s, my grandfather came over on a boat from Austria-Hungary in May 1914. It would have been very unlikely for somebody like him to have attended Groton. He would have been in the class in the 1920s. But the WASPs did play a part in establishing our meritocracy and opened up their school. So I came to Groton as Alsup would have called a tribal outsider, but it welcomed us outsiders. And I think it did give us, I hope, the good aspects of the WASPs, their desire to do justice to their powers and try to live lives that aren't just narrowly successful in a particular groove, but with some mindfulness of contributing to the community and to developing a broad array of interests in a sort of old humane tradition.
How did you get into this book? How long did it take you? And I can tell you, as someone who considers himself a generalist and not an intellectual, this book requires time because you have lots of big words in it.
Yeah, maybe that's the disagreeable aspect of a Groton education, is the being too wordy. Joe Alsup was certainly, I guess, verbose and quite ornamental in his style. But it took me 3 years, and it was my way of trying to understand that the institutions that had shaped me were, in fact, they were WASP institutions, and I was trying to sort of come to grips with what that meant and who were these people that have had a great influence, not only on me, but anybody who attends any of these schools that they have founded or visits one of the museums that they subsidized. And there was a interesting article written by Samuel Goldman, professor of political science at George Washington University, saying that though the WASPs have lost their place in as shapers of American culture today, they're no longer the people that hold the offices, their institutions are still some of the dominant ones that shape our larger cultural life. And he said, you know, they sort of won by losing.
A word that you use a lot in your book, and correct me if I pronounce it incorrectly, neurasthenia.
Yeah, neurasthenia.
What does the word mean, and why did you use it so often?
Well, it in Greek it means unhealthy nerves or sick nerves, but what the WASPs understood it as sort of the funk they fell into in the Gilded Age when they felt they were falling behind in life. They weren't living up to the traditions of their ancestors. They were like Henry Adams and feeling uncomfortable with their lack of an impact on their country. So I think it was a great motivator of the WASPs to try and get out of their lassitudes and do something. And that's what they did. And I think their methods of education, of sort of forming character, this sort of stuff that's now considered a little bit dodgy and old-fashioned. In fact, I think the WASPs found that sort of character molding quite effective in getting them up and doing things.
Here's a word I looked up and could not find a definition. And I need your help on this. I'll probably mess this pronunciation. Plasgogorza.
Yes, I think that's sort of a combination of the different civic centers, the Roman Forum, the Greek Agora, the old marketplaces that were before the days of TV and radio and books. People got their culture, their ideas of, you know, history, their news from these places that were at the center of every local community, and they developed quite extraordinary methods of influencing people and sort of influencing their character. This was very much the Athenian idea, Pericles, that we're going to produce what he called citizens that can be good at not just one thing, but many things, this sort of broad-minded approach to citizenship. And the WASPs, I think, were always attracted to that idea. They all went on sort of grand tours of Europe and other pre-modern cultures, not just in Europe, but also in Asia. And they came away thinking that this is sort of what's missing in America. We don't have any longer these kinds of centers where people can, in a social setting, encounter things that will sort of develop their own inner potential or aspirations.
I want to go back to Joe Alsop just for a second and run another clip because, it's the sound of his voice and what he says that I want you to talk about.
Old-fashioned snobbery, I mean, don't mean social snobbery, but intellectual snobbery, is disapproved of, which it is in this country. It's not in England or in Europe. If intellectual snobbery is disapproved of, the standard goes down. It's inevitable.
Did you ever consider yourself an intellectual snob?
Yes, I am, certainly.
Oh, you still are?
Yes. I much prefer the first rate to the second rate.
What is an intellectual snob? Can you define it? And do you live around many people that consider themselves intellectual snobs?
Do I?
Yes,
are we
yes.
Still on Joe, or are we now to me?
Well, both Joe and you. I mean, just talk about what he said and whether or not...
Yes, no, I think that this was part of it. This was the idea that the WASPs believe that there are virtues to having a certain kind of elite, that they will help cultivate taste, they will uphold standards. It's very much a part of probably the great novelist who was an honorary WASP, Henry James. It's a great theme in his novel that the old elites of Europe, the aristocracies, were tremendously terrible in many respects in the unfairness of their privilege. But he said that, you know, without them, we would not have had a lot of the civilization we have had. You know, all that artwork in the museums was partly the result of patrons and an elite that was looking to distinguish the better artists from the worse. I mean, that's why you have Raphael's work in the Vatican or Michelangelo's, was this desire for excellence, which I think that's what was very much on Alsop's mind.
And what about today? Is there snobbery in the United States today, and where do you see it?
I think the intellectual snobbery has come down since I don't think there's as much of it, which can be both good and bad. I think if you look at the way we talk, we write, it's all much more, we're much more welcoming and open. On the other hand, you could also say that our level of taste, if you go into the local supermarket or shopping mall, it's not quite what you would have experienced perhaps in Venice or some old European center where there would be a great deal of art and poetry and sort of a larger conception of human possibility.
I'm looking at chapter 29 of your book, and there's a picture of Whitaker Chambers, and underneath it says, a WASP radical, Whitaker Chambers helped mobilize forces that would doom the ascendancy of his kind, put him in perspective in the WASP world.
Well, Whitaker was born from a WASP family that was going downhill. Unlike the Adamses or the Roosevelts or the Alsops, they were losing their position, losing their money. Whitaker Chambers was, yet he imbibed partly from his experience at Columbia, where there was a humanities program that had been influenced by, indirectly, by Harvard humanists. He had this idea of doing justice to his own potential, and he saw no way to reconcile that ideal with the Roaring Twenties. So he was not one to do things by half measures. He became a communist. 10 years in the Communist Party convinced him that, well, as he said, I heard the screams, and he became a founder of the modern conservative movement. But his whole his basic approach to life didn't change. He shifted across the political spectrum, but he, you know, he had this farm in Maryland where he thought he could do justice to aspects of his nature that he couldn't do. His day job was as a very successful writer for Time magazine, but he thought, you know, you need to have a broader set of interests in life. So that was Whitaker Chambers, carrying the WASP humanism into the mid-20th century, while at the same time becoming quite critical of the mid-century WASP elite, which he thought Dean Acheson, for example, was insufficiently tough on communism, which I don't know if that, I think Whitaker himself backed off of that, but Dean Acheson was quite a convinced and dedicated Cold Warrior.
You mentioned the next person I'm going to bring up several times in the book, and I kind of want to get at the question by asking you about when you hear somebody say, if I don't care if it's a social setting or friends or whatever, that they've just finished reading Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. What is that? What vibe does that send out to somebody? And have you read it, by the way?
Yeah, I've read it in English, but not French. But I guess it would be. I guess it's a snobbish vibe, but it's a work that I'm trying to think how I would connect it to.
Well, character. I mean, it's 3,000 pages, 7 different volumes. I once interviewed Shelby Foote when he was alive, and he used to say that when he would finish writing, you know, several hundred thousand words about the Civil War, he would entertain himself for a couple months by reading Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. And as you well know, it's not exactly easy reading. Why do people read it, and how does it fit into the intellectual
world? I think it spoke to WASP a lot because it covers some of the issues which they were very much involved in. Proust is dealing with the difference between old elites and new elites. He's describing a waning old French aristocracy coming to terms with new classes that are rising up, with people who are rich American heiresses are marrying French princes, and the difficulties of maintaining elite standards in a changed age. I think that would have spoken tremendously. It spoke tremendously, for example, to Edmund Wilson, who is, in addition to being one of the greatest American critics of the 20th century was very much influenced by WASP culture. And it was probably Wilson's first book, Axel's Castle, that introduced a lot of English-speaking readers, or at least helped English-speaking readers understand what Proust was doing and what he was about.
Let me go back to, we were talking about education earlier. If you went to the University of Illinois and you went to a public high school in Chicago and you didn't go beyond that, what's the difference for somebody that went to Groton, Columbia, Cambridge, and Yale? I mean, you know, what? can you get the same education if you don't go to these elite schools on the East Coast?
Oh, yes. Yes, you can. Education really depends. The WASPs that show up in my book were ones that responded to certain aspects of their education, as Endicott Peabody lamented of his Groton graduates. A lot of them, you know, most of them are not interested in those kinds of things and are, you know, content to be stockbrokers. But I think there's a certain self-selection involved. Yes, I think you'd be more likely to be exposed to it if you've gone through to schools that have maintained some of these old humanities approaches to education. But anybody that opens a book and is moved by it can get very much the same kind of education.
As you went through the writing of this book and researching this book, who were your favorites? Where did you find the most joy out of researching and writing?
I frankly came to really enjoy hanging out with Joe Alsup sort of vicariously. What a character. His humor, he was not an altogether pleasant man. I mean, he bullied his wife. He got up in the morning and seemed to spend a lot of his day putting people in their place. Could be a terrific snob, but extremely entertaining. I think Edmund Wilson's another WASP character whose his writings he helped introduce English speaking readers to Proust, as we were saying, and carried on a lot of the sort of WASP ideal of developing different aspects of your nature and personality into the 20th century, and left quite a remarkable record in that way.
What do you want people to take for, let me ask it different. Who do you envision reading the book, and then what do you want them to take away?
It's hard to, I think one of the problems with writing today is the division between the creator, the writer, and the audience. It's been quite a problem really ever since printed books came. Before, you know, we were talking about these centers of old pre-modern life where everybody gathered for entertainment and news and understanding the world in a compact civic space. And there, the person that had the artistic or creative vocation he knew his audience. They were right there. You see somebody like Shakespeare is right on sort of the fringe between the world of playing for a particular audience in person and then writing impersonally for people who will read it about in books. So while you can't really know your audience in that way today, I would say that anybody who's sort of tempted a little bit by this WASP idea of, they would phrase it, I think, as an idea of human completion, of not discarding certain aspects of your nature for which you might not find an immediate outlet in life. At the same time, though, I guess I would caution any person who takes the WASP humanist ideal too seriously, is that it's something that's becoming ever harder to pursue or cultivate in life. The WASPs, of course, many of them, you know, they had trust funds and private income. They could, they had a certain margin in life where they could develop different aspects of themselves. I think that's much harder to do now. I mean, if you work at a job, you've got to do your best in that job, and it's much harder to live that broad-minded ideal that the WASPs had. And it could, I suppose, in some circumstances, actually be harmful.
What did they think of money?
Oh, well, they loved it. I mean, Joe also said, what's the definition of success in America? He said, it's money, and that's a good thing. they knew it was important. I think they, because they had it in general, they had ancestors who'd made it for them. They could take a more, they didn't worry, a lot of them didn't have to worry about it as much as most of us do. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, for example, he could never have pursued the career that he did without the fact that his mother's money paid for it, for most of it.
Other than the big names that you write about, the WASPs, Franklin Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Teddy Roosevelt, who were some of the other names of people that you write about that had an important impact on the United States?
Well, I think Endicott Peabody and William Emery Gardner, the founders of Groton, are not going to be very well known to most people, but they founded a school where they did try and create this sort of what Richard Hofstadter, the historian, called a little Greek democracy for the elite. This was, you know, the idea that you were going to create a little mini Athens and use it to shape people's, young people's minds. And they did that, and by some definitions, you'd say it really worked. It was a success.
Now, I quoted you saying a couple things about Franklin Roosevelt and his wife, and his Franklin Roosevelt's mother. You said that his mother, Sarah, was a tight-fisted old witch. And you called...
She could be mean, yes.
You called Franklin a charming man. And then you said Eleanor omitted to shave her armpits. What brought it that kind of thing on for you when you're writing about this?
Oh, I thought these interesting details in life are... it's just interesting. This was a piece of... When one of the Roosevelt sons married into another WASP family, the Cushing sisters, they were the Cushings were sort of alarmed that Eleanor was so what would be the right word? So I guess advanced or heedless of conventions in her behavior, and they did notice the armpits. But I think these details make history interesting. I mean, I wouldn't want to leave that out. It's just, to me, it was an interesting thing. I would never have occurred to me to even think about, but there it was in the record.
How did Babe Paley get in your book? And who was she?
Well, she was one of the fabulous Cushing sisters who they all married into quite well-known WASP families, the Roosevelts, the Whitneys, and... had a great impact on the fashion of mid-20th century life. I mean, before Jacqueline Kennedy, it was really Babe Paley who was the swan that that people looked up to as a model of sort of style, elegance, good living in the 20th century.
But Babe Paley was married to Bill Paley, who owned CBS by and large. But the reason
that was her second marriage.
The reason I mentioned that is because what was their relationship, and then where did Truman Capote come into this?
Well, Babe Paley was initially married to Stanley Mortimer, a Standard Oil heir. That marriage didn't work, and I think Bill Paley was, by WASP standards of the day, a sort of exotic character, sort of. Very successful man, very dominating, at a time when the WASPs were starting to sort of lose their, I guess we would say, mojo, their charisma or whatever it is that allows you to dominate. So Bill Paley, she marries him, and he is really a dominant figure in the mid-20th century, shaping a lot of the stuff that those of us of a certain age, you know, grew up with watching on television. So she sort of is a WASP who learned to accommodate herself to a new world.
And what was their marriage like?
I don't know. It lasted, but there seemed to have been tensions, but I suppose that's can be true of many marriages.
Another name in literary history that you mentioned several times in the book is Dante. Who was he, and why do you use him a lot to describe some of these people?
Yes, he was a poet from Florence in Italy, and his Divine Comedy is a story of how he enters hell and goes up through purgatory and finally reaches Paradise. It was a book that the Wasps, when they sort of reinvented themselves after the Civil War, turned to all the time. So you can't read their writings, their letters, without feeling how much he spoke to them. And I think it was the idea that you may find yourself in sort of a hellish place in life, but there is hope that you can get out, in Dante's words, get out of the dark places and find a place where you can see the stars.
What was the most valuable research you found in this, and where did you find it?
Well, I would have to say it was probably attending the WASP schools that I did, because that really gave me some understanding of what was going on that I could never have done just by reading books.
What did you think of it when you were there?
I liked it. I thought it was very much what Peabody and Gardner tried to do in my time. There had been a whole other element in between at Groton that was not so pretty. There was a lot of hysteria about sexuality in an earlier period in the 20th century. So there was a lot of bullying and things of that nature that were meant to keep the boys in line. I think that explains why Joe Alsup, who was very grateful for the teaching he got at Groton, found it a very unpleasant experience with the bullying and the institutional hazing, which by my time had been eliminated.
Is it today men only?
No. Girls were admitted in the mid-1970s, and two of my daughters have gone there, and it's it remains, I think, a very special place, and one that I think really does remain true to what I think was one good aspect of the old WASP idea, which is to try and take a person and bring out their talents and abilities.
I think I wrote it down. I think this is a quote from you, and I wanted you to explain it. Beware of boredom with public officials.
It sounds... yeah, I don't know what context I was quoting it, but...
Well, beyond that, you say FDR was bored with domestic policies and that
yeah,
might have had...
Yeah, I think FDR always liked... He just liked action and change, and he was a very, very restless man. He didn't sit through meetings following sort of charts about what... He mostly talked. Yet somehow he managed, just through sort of joking and talking through all these meetings, to navigate the country through a bunch of major crises. He's quite a mystery as to how exactly he did that.
So the rest of your education, what did you take away from Columbia?
Well, there it was. They had this core curriculum, which had been inspired a Harvard professor who'd been educated at Harvard, George Woodbury, came to Columbia, and one of his students created the series of humanities courses that are known as the core curriculum. Whitaker Chambers experienced them, first studied Dante, who was an important influence on Chambers' life in the Columbia core curriculum. And probably its most notable exponent, the person who spoke about it most eloquently, was the critic Lionel Trilling, who was not in any sense a WASP by birth, but who found the core curriculum a tremendous sort of, I would say, I guess life-changing would be the word we'd use now, a life-changing experience in his idea of how great works of art, the imagination, can shape the soul or liberate its potential.
What did you take away from Cambridge?
Cambridge, you sort of see aspects of an older community that has maintained some of these humane standards of learning for centuries. So it was sort of a little awe-inspiring for an American who, when we're in a place that's 100 or 200 years old, we think it's quite ancient, whereas you go to Cambridge and you're continuously sort of surrounded or overshadowed by a culture that goes back almost 1,000 years.
And finally, what did you take away from Yale?
Well, the good thing, or not good thing, depending, I guess, how you look at it, is Yale is very forgiving in terms of letting students pursue their own interests. So you might not necessarily learn a lot of law if you don't want to, but you can feel free to pursue your own interests. And Yale Law School is very generous in allowing students to find ways to do that.
How was this book experience compared to the other four you've written?
I think it was... It's much stronger because I was reporting something that I just had some connection to personally, writing about Robert Kennedy or the 1860s with Lincoln and Bismarck. You know, I'm getting it through books. And while I'm not myself a WASP and not connected to WASPs really by family or birth, having experienced their institutions gave me, I think, a feeling for things that were possibly overlooked in what they accomplished by other writers, even though the writings might be very illuminating. But to have actually gone through the experience is just always very different. I've always thought if a classical scholar could go to, say, the Roman Forum for 5 minutes, it would probably alter his perspective on the whole thing tremendously, just because he'd seen it even for a brief time. And that's sort of how I feel about writing about the WASP experience.
Your name, Michael Knox Barron, where does Knox come from?
My mother's family. They would, I guess, be technically WASPs in the sense of genetics or whatever, but they weren't. They were from the Midwest, so they weren't in touch with the culture I sort of got introduced when I went to boarding school.
Any relationship to Henry Knox, the former Secretary of War?
I don't think, no. I don't think so, no. Or if it would be, it would be very distant.
And the name Barron, where does that come from?
Well, my grandfather in 1914 came from what was then Austria-Hungary. He was living in Croatia. I think the name is more commonly found in the Czech Republic. But I suppose this was another aspect of my experience in writing the book. Like many Americans, I'm a melting pot creation of different traditions and different cultural heritages, which is a great thing, but you find with each generation the cultural strength sort of peters out as everybody sort of homogenizes things to get along. And it was an experience to go to a school like Groton, which in some ways hadn't changed in some of its forms in almost 100 years, to experience what I think anthropologists would call thick culture, as opposed to the thinner culture that is more characteristic of our modern homogenized life. And that that was eye-opening to see that at the age of 13.
As we wrap this up, I do have to ask you, did you like WASPs?
The people?
Yeah.
Yes, all of them I've known. They've actually been charming, funny, quite good people. That's been my experience. I never, by my time, the sort of some of the eccentricities of Joe Alsup, though, had been much more leveled off. People didn't speak like that at Groton in the 1980s, the way Joe Alsup was speaking. The WASPs, too, have sort of thinned down their culture over the years.
We got to do one more quote from Joe Alsup because it's his chance to drop names and get your reaction to this.
Well, Henry Kissinger was the cleverest man I've ever known.
The cleverest man you've ever known.
And the man I admired most was General Marshall, from his character. General Marshall to Harry Hopkins, curiously enough, at the end, when I really got to know him in the war. Dean Acheson was a most distinguished man. Bob Lovett was a marvelous man. I mean, it sounds as though I was talking about the remote past.
Could you just...
But it's very hard to see anyone that matches those men now.
Mr. Barron?
Well, of course, he's talking about people that... Dean Acheson and Bob Lovett are very much part of the WASP ascendancy. Dean Acheson was at Groton a decade before Joe Alsup graduated. General Marshall maintained a similar old-fashioned, cavalier tradition of gentleman-like behavior. So again, there was sort of a common denominator. And Henry Kissinger, you could almost say, is in some ways an honorary WASP. He went to Harvard and took to heart its idea of developing different aspects of your nature, and you'd certainly say he did. Between his extraordinary scholarship in diplomacy and his actual achievements as a statesman and a public servant, extremely impressive stuff. But with an underlying, I think, idea of developing his different talents and not just focusing on any one of them.
Of all the people you write about in your book, which one would you most like to have dinner with?
I suppose Alsup, but, well, except for the fact that he'd probably be bored, and when he was bored, he'd be awfully intimidating. But he really, I think, thanks to those C-SPAN interviews, you really can't see when you spoke to him, it must have been a very sort of interesting performance. I certainly found it so, seeing it on tape.
Oh, absolutely. It was, it's available for anybody that wants to watch him on our archives, and there are a couple of hours of it back in 1984. But
it occurs to me it's almost as though there was this sort of acting theatrical aspect about him. He really dominates the camera with his mannerisms, his way of speaking, his pauses, his the whole presentation, which I think probably did go into other WASP characters like Franklin Roosevelt, this sort of almost stagecraft in which they presented themselves.
You should have tried to interview him. Anyway, thank you, Michael Knox Barron. The book is called WASPs. The subtitle is The Splendors and Miseries of an American Aristocracy. Enjoyed our chat. Thanks for joining us today. And what's the next book?
Brian.
What's the next book?
Not sure yet. Not sure yet.
Well, good luck. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Brian.
Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.